Hey, David, put on the lav mic down there, just for Alex to turn it on.
Is this one, or?
No, that, right there.
That's the same one from earlier in the class, just so you know, it's been a bit underwear.
Nice.
That looked creepy, thanks for that.
Right then? Be good.
Okay, always helpful.
No. Okay. So, my project is about basically exploring the idea of poker addiction. As you guys all know, we've talked about poker a lot during class, and whenever people talk about regulation, one of the first things that comes up is addiction. In addition, in my own life, in kind of my personal relationships, you know, people have said, oh, you're kind of addicted to poker or something like that. So I wanted to think about that a little bit more. And so what I'm talking about today is focusing on what I'm calling the time sink aspect of poker addiction. So when you think about poker addiction, there's a lot of different kind of definitions that are floating around out there. What I did here is kind of look at some of those definitions, and most of them include some concept of money, like you're losing money by playing a lot of poker, and so therefore you're addicted to it. Time, you're spending a lot of time playing poker, and some kind of emotional component to it. My project is kind of focusing on the time component and figuring out kind of what it means, why does it exist, why do people spend so much time playing poker, and then maybe kind of what we can do about it. You know, there's, like I said, there's a lot of different definitions as to what kind of poker addiction is or is not. You know, I'm not really going to dive into too many of the details, but the website kind of lists, you know, what I thought were some of the best or most well thought out definitions of poker addiction. Actually, the government of Australia spent a couple of years focusing on trying to define gambling addiction generally, and they came up with, you know, a list of eight factors that they thought were kind of the most common elements among the different theories out there. And I've color-coded them here. You know, the green factors are factors that kind of represent money. And you'll see that, you know, people don't really talk as much about the time elements of poker addiction when they kind of look to define it. The same thing is true if you look at the definition of the DSM-4, which is kind of the psychiatrist's definition of gambling addiction. You see the same general idea where there's a lot of focus on the money, more on the emotional, and not as much on the time. So what I wanted to do is kind of think about, you know, with that general conception of the definition of addiction, try to think about what about poker causes us to spend so much time playing it. You know, is there something unique to poker? And so I kind of looked at the game and thought, well, I mean, there's certain things about it that are just structural. You know, it takes a long time to play poker. In particular, it takes a long time to play tournament poker. Part of that is just the idea that, you know, to win at poker takes kind of coming up with the right combination of a good hand and a marginally weaker hand in your opponent. And that takes a lot of iterations. Right here I just have kind of the top hand groupings that are recommended, you know, for players to kind of think about playing pre-flop. And, you know, in general, and these are just kind of playable hands. In general, you know, people won't play, you know, group five through seven, and there's plenty of hands that you don't even play. So a lot of the time, when you're playing poker, you're kind of waiting for you know, good hands to come and then to kind of come up against a weaker hand. In addition, it takes a long time, especially in tournament poker, to kind of come into situations that are new, especially as you progress in your skill level. You know, when you first start playing, you kind of have to learn how to play the game, and it's maybe exciting and, you know, there's a lot that you're kind of learning. But as you progress, a lot of the game kind of becomes, fairly repetitive. And, in order to kind of progress from amateur to intermediate to really good, you have to confront the nuances of, being at a final table and having a medium-sized stack. What do you do in these situations? And it just takes a long time in order for, the different kinds of situations to play out just because of the structure of the game. And finally, just kind of thinking about, one of the more biological definitions of addiction out there. Some people at Harvard did some research, and they were kind of trying to equate gambling addiction with more, other kinds of addiction like drug addictions and alcohol addictions. And they focused on kind of the subjective effect that you get from the game. When you're really excited, you get this adrenaline rush, and they kind of looked at brain receptors and stuff like that. And as expected, in poker and gambling generally, but poker especially, you don't get these rushes that often because you're kind of not faced with these exciting situations that often. So the idea is just that because of the structure of the game, it takes a long time to get what you want out of it, whether it is just to play it, whether it is to kind of learn and progress, or if you're kind of really looking for some kind of adrenaline rush. So,
it's going to take 15 minutes, so leave about half for discussion.
Okay, yeah, I'm just going to walk through really quickly. I wanted to point out that, poker is not the only, what I'll call, intellectual game that takes a lot of time. Scrabble, both online and offline, takes a lot of time. Part of it is just because it takes a long time to play the game. Reading a novel, another thing that takes a long time, kind of an intellectual activity.
Stop now. What's your argument?
Well, I'm almost to... My argument is that poker, because of the structure of the game, takes a lot of time. Just because it takes a lot of time to play, because it takes a lot of time to kind of learn.
Poker takes a lot of time. That's your argument?
That is one of the reasons... That's why I think people seem to... one of the things that emerges from kind of what appears as addiction may just be part of the structure of the game. In other words,
who do you imagine yourself to be arguing against or with?
Let me kind of talk about the solutions that I have, and maybe that will kind of the last bullet here, I say the purpose of this site is to bring awareness to the time sink aspect of poker and to suggest that maybe through innovation we can eliminate the need for regulatory solutions. In other words, people look at poker and they say, oh, it's addictive, let's kind of regulate it. Well, other people have thought about kind of ways of dealing with the money aspect of poker. Maybe you can create an online community where people don't put money in, and so therefore, we can kind of eliminate that aspect. What I'm focusing on is the idea that even if we have an online community where you don't put money into the site, people are still going to be spending a lot of time on it just because of the structure of the game. So what I'm suggesting is that there may be ways that we can use technology to kind of change the way people are introduced to the game, change the way people play the game, so that we can kind of deal with what I'm calling the time sink aspect of poker addiction. And those solutions are, the first is the idea of creating kind of simulated learning environments. And this is really just, what the title entails. You have like a poker room where you kind of go in as if you're sitting down at a poker table. And instead of playing a full game, you're kind of introduced. Here it says, imagine you're sitting at the button and you're Delta 10-10. The players check around to you and they raise two times the blind. The player in the big blind goes all in. What do you do? Kind of presenting people with situations where they're already in a context and they have to make that, that nuanced decision that they're kind of looking for when you're playing a four-hour tournament. Or you could have other kinds of, situations. Say there are four players at the table.
Your argument is that the amount of time people spend is a bad thing?
I'm saying that it can be a bad thing. because it may take away from other things in your life. I mean, it may take away from kind of your ability to, I don't know, kind of the reasons why, just kind of going back to, I think I'm stipulating that when people define poker addiction, or people define gambling addiction generally, just looking at Australia, for instance, or Gamblers Anonymous, DSM-4, this is Australia. Basically, because of the time it takes to play the game, you neglect commitments, or you kind of, you know, you make gambling maybe more important. You're kind of spending a lot of time doing it. And it may not be because, you know, you can't get enough of the game, but just because it takes 4 hours to play a tournament.
All right, let's have some time for comment.
So that's it. And I had some other solutions just really quickly. There's a game out there called Speed Poker. I don't know if you people have heard of, but it's like you have 15 seconds to act. It accelerates the game, and then there's turbo tournaments and stuff like that. So that's it. That's kind of the general gist.
If you take the money element out of the addiction for online poker, the thing that I see it relating most to is like massively multiplayer online games like World of Warcraft. Did you look into comparing some of the solutions that have been suggested in there and stuff like that?
Yeah, I had that on my final kind of picture here, is people playing video games. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think it is similar. And, you know, one of the solutions that I was thinking about is, it's kind of related, but I don't know if it's exactly related, but it's the idea of kind of, you know, one of the things that happens in cash games in poker, which is kind of cool, is you have like this long-term, let's say you're playing at the same casino over time, you play with the same people, and so you've got a certain presence and a table presence, people know who you are. Right now, when you go to PokerStars, you have a name and maybe a picture, but people don't really know who you are, so there's no real identity there. I think by maybe opening up the tournaments to more kind of identity-oriented, maybe giving people better avatars or better identities online, they can maybe step away from the table and kind of continue building that presence that you can do in an offline environment. So I don't know if that's similar to MMORPG solution, but it's the way to kind of chop up the games.
So who is the audience you imagine yourself speaking to?
Anyone who thinks that, basically anyone who's concerned with people spending too much time playing poker, or people who think that, you know, that the time element of poker addiction is relevant.
But your illustrations with poker is not likely to be even understood by those people. Those people that don't want to have anything to do with poker. So
maybe it's just kind of for people who are thinking of ways to come up with creative solutions that aren't regulatory in nature, ways to kind of create maybe an online community or something else where, or somehow tailor the game or tailor online communities.
Us poker players will get together and we'll organize the world so
we can create
faster.
Yeah, make it faster or like give people alternatives for, especially if you're learning the game, you know. You don't have to sit at a tournament for 5 hours to kind of beat your first final table. You can get introduced to it.
Okay.
Do you think one of the advantages is the fact that poker takes a long time?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, so there is a certain, so there's like social aspects. So like if you're playing it in person, the idea of kind of hanging out for 4 or 5 hours playing poker is great, and the time is good. In terms of online, you know, low limit tournament poker for people who are intermediate to advanced, I don't really know that the time really matters that much, especially like if you're like a 200 or 1,000 person tournament, the first hour or so you're going to maybe have like 5 or 6 or 7 hands that really matter. And sure, the rest of it's kind of interesting, but I don't know. It's not as interesting.
Especially all right, David, thank you very much.
Cool.
And I kind of scaled my project down from my initial statement because I realized it was kind of unwieldy and not very practical. So instead of making an argument in general about my entire life being open and being free in public.
On the Windows machines, you not only have to plug it in, but
do the properties. All right. Slideshow, but I'll do it in print regular. Yeah, switch it to just, we talked a little bit in class about this earlier, about body modifications like piercings and tattoos in a professional setting. And so I just want to start off with some popular tattoo statistics. Since a couple of the major search engines have started tracking their searches, tattoo is one of only 7 terms not to fall out of the top 50. The other 7 being Pamela Anderson, Britney Spears, WWE, WWF, and stuff like that. So it's a popular category of research. During the 2002 calendar year, it peaked at number 3 for searches. Lycos no longer counts it in its numbers because so many people look at it and they feel it's such a broad category that they don't. It's like retired like a sports number. Ask.com ranks tattoo as the number 1 beauty/fashion search term since 2003. Back tattoos ranked the highest, with neck being 2nd, which I thought was interesting because neck is kind of a visible place to have a tattoo, especially if you're going to be working. And butterfly, fairy, and tribal tattoos rank among the most popular search for. Tattoo statistics. This was a recent Harris poll. I found that 16% of
adults. This is an abuse of the audience.
It's an abuse of the audience?
Yes. Put up a slide with the print so small that nobody can read it.
Well, I'll read it for you guys.
You go to view show. Yeah. Under slideshow, click bigger. Under slideshow.
I didn't know if this was gonna.
You probably have to set it up so that it goes to the other screen.
Yeah.
Might be maximize it though on that screen.
There you go. I was going to do these real quick. 16% of people over 18 have a tattoo. 25 to 29-year-olds have the highest rate with almost 40%, and it falls off in both directions at almost a bell curve rate. The American Academy of Dermatology places the percentage of Americans between 18 and 50 with a tattoo at 24%. The East, South, and Midwest all are around 16%, with the West Coast showing a 20% rate of body art for people over the age of 18. Males and females are both equally likely to have body art. Most racial groups are in the 16% rate, plus or minus 2%. Democrats are most likely at 18%, with Republicans slightly behind at 14% and Independents at 12%. Only 17% of those with a tattoo regret the decision at the time the poll was taken, with the number one reason being 16% of those who regretted it saying that they had the name of an ex or a wife tattooed that they were no longer with. 34% of people reported that tattoos made them feel sexier, 29% more rebellious, 20% more spiritual, and 26% more attractive, while people without tattoos reported that they felt 31% of people asked said people with tattoos were less intelligent, 42% less attractive, 29% less spiritual, and 21% less healthy. And this was my really interesting disconnect that I found. Less than 1/3, as I said before, I think it was 29%, tattooed individuals felt that their tattoo made them feel more rebellious, whereas almost twice as many, 57% of non-tattooed individuals saw tattoos as marking somebody as more rebellious. So I thought that was an interesting disconnect between the two groups of people. I did some interviews with some people who had experienced a situation where their tattoos or piercings were commented on in the workplace. A lawyer from Houston had somebody
he said that they don't have a dress code per se, but I do know that clients have certain expectations when they walk into a professional's office. It got back to me about how one of my clients made some derogatory comment about my piercings. A chemical engineer from Louisiana said, I wear 5 earrings to work every day, but that's the extent of my visible piercings. I have no visible ink, and I keep retainers in my tongue and septum. I've already been told that my appearance is going to keep me from holding my boss's job. An accountant said that she had her nape pierced a while back, and she had to do the best to hide it while in the office. A head nurse told another ER nurse in Canada that she's a less competent individual because she has piercings and tattoos. And a guy who works in the physics department of HP said that not a day goes by when I don't get approached by upper management with their, you know, if you want to move up in the company, you might want to start thinking about taking some of those out speech. So just goes to show kind of what the current status is for people who have piercings and tattoos in the workplace. And then this is kind of like my plan for what I wanted to do with this project. My first step was I wanted to create an online forum for modified professionals to disseminate information, kind of post the post articles written about it, maybe get people to share their stories about what they felt were some of the situations in the workplace that resulted from them having tattoos or piercings. From there, I wanted to kind of try and influence the discussion on the forum away from resentment and frustration and kind of venting about people's kind of like negative feelings about being discriminated against in the workplace because of visible piercings and tattoos, and then kind of move it towards concerning an effort for change. And then use this altered discussion to create a sense of responsibility in people with piercings and tattoos to kind of like go out of their way to show people in the workplace, at the grocery store, you know, just regular people they interact with, that they're not necessarily more rebellious or, you know, more apt to have been arrested or anything like that. That, you know, it's just kind of an aesthetic decision made. And kind of have these people provide a responsible alternative to modified individuals who do not act appropriately. So like the kids who are hanging out in the pit in Harvard Square and just kind of, you know, drinking in public and stuff like that. From there, it would be a job of the forum to kind of keep spirits up, I guess, maintain the program long enough that the average unmodified person has enough exposure to good and responsible modified people that they don't automatically presume irresponsibility and rebelliousness when they see somebody with piercings or tattoos. Because I don't think it's ever going to be in people's minds that you see somebody with, you know, a septum piercing, for example, and you think, oh, he's intelligent and he's probably going places. But I think we can switch the association enough that people will have enough exposure to responsible members of the modified community that their automatic assumption will be this person could be somebody who's responsible, especially if they're, you know, if they've got good credentials, if they are holding a job as a doctor or a lawyer or anything like that. And yeah, just kind of increase the open-mindedness there. So that's how I want to make my argument.
All right, good.
How do you think popular culture is going to play into it? I know that shows like Miami Ink, LA Ink have been pretty popular, but that I don't necessarily know that that would really help your cause any, the depiction of people getting tattoos and that. I mean, how do you feel about that, or how does it play into it?
I personally like those shows. They're kind of interesting to me just to see why people are doing stuff. I think it gets a discussion going, and I think it gets kind of a view from the inside. I mean, you see those shows and the people are joking around a lot, but they're also, you know, coming together, forming a business, they're running a successful enterprise. So I think it's a positive role model in the community to see somebody who's running a business responsibly in the national spotlight. I mean, there's obviously, I'm not arguing that everybody with a tattoo and a piercing is a responsible member of society. And you know, you can see from those shows that a lot of people who come in don't have the best backgrounds, but you also see plenty of people who come in there who, you know, lost a loved one and have cat tattoo, a portrait on them, and they're like a 40-year-old, you know, structural engineer or something like that, and it's, you know, it does a good job of showing the entire community instead of just pigeonholing it into a rebellious aspect of it.
Are you trying to sort of separate the modified community into two different types of people with tattoos, like those who are sort of, you know, the biker criminal type, and those who are sort of the, you know, the people who are responsible and, you know, got a butterfly tattoo on their navel when they were 18 and, you know, since then have become Rhodes Scholars?
The community has kind of separated itself into those, and you get the people, you know, you get the bikers and stuff complaining about the people who, you know, are lawyers who have tattoos, saying, oh, you know, they're not really living the tattoo lifestyle. And then you have the people who are lawyers with tattoos saying, oh, they're ruining it for the rest of us by acting like idiots when they're highly tattooed and people make the association. So I think the community's already split. I just want to kind of provide a forum for the people who want to kind of push on this responsible side of the community, an outlet to get together and kind of make a concerted effort where, you know, instead of just going out there and kind of acting like they normally would and hoping that people will come around eventually, to make it a concerted, over-the-top, outgoing effort to introduce themselves to people who don't have piercings and tattoos, who might have a negative association with them, to kind of show them that not everybody with piercings and tattoos is, you know, the biker or used to be in the Navy or anything like that.
That's actually quite a striking position in a way. It's like you're advocating becoming a like professional tattoo.
Almost, yeah.
It's like, and a lot of people who have individualized characteristics would like not to have to live their life being the professional Jew or the professional black or the professional this or the professional that. Mm-hmm. Would rather just be able to walk through the society and not have that be the thing that people relate to and that they have to relate to back to.
And as far as I'm concerned, that's fine. I'm just, what I want to get is enough people who feel this is an important thing to have done in society to come together and kind of make this concerted effort. So if you're, you know, a lawyer with full sleeve tattoos who hides it every day, tries to keep it away from their coworker, and doesn't want that to define them in the workplace, that's fine. Don't be, you know, a spokesperson for, you know, my movement, because I, you know, I don't need every single person to be a spokesperson. I'm just trying to get as many people as possible into this kind of like outgoing spokesperson role that the average person has enough exposure to it that they will no longer, you know, look at somebody with a full sleeve of a tattoo and be like, oh, that's...
Can the government discriminate against people with tattoos?
Yes. It's not a protected class.
Can they? Or
yeah, they can.
They
can. There's, in fact, there was a really clever idea that in implementation just did everything wrong. A church tried to start to form that had... It was an offshoot of, like, kind of the... whatever the unified Christian church is, that just like you can apply to be a deacon online, but it tried to have as part of their doctrine that piercings and tattoos were the way that you worshiped through your faith and tried to get protected status that way, but it ended up being a huge like pyramid scheme almost. But yeah, there's been a few, it hasn't really gone far in any court, but there's been a few cases and it's pretty much been ruled against that.
What conceivably is the legislative basis for the government saying that one can't paint their bodies?
It's not the government saying people can't paint their bodies, and in fact the government actually said you couldn't paint your body until about 4 years ago. That's when the tattoo, the government used to ban all tattoos. Any tattoo that you saw that was gotten before about 2002 was most likely done illegally. But the basis for being allowed to fire somebody on it is that if the person is in a position where they are the face of the company in some way, and that's in their job description, that they have to conform to company standards for how they present themselves to other people, then the courts have ruled that that is a legitimate basis to fire somebody or not hire them based on having tattoos and piercings that are visible.
And that includes the government?
Oh, I don't know about the government, actually. But I do know that...
I'm interested because...
I know about the armed services. I don't know about the government in general. The armed services has passed a number of...
One of the oddities of Jamaican life is that a lot of the kids get tattoos and then later on decide they would like to, you know, get a job in the security forces. Mm-hmm. And they find that they're not allowed to because the tattoo is in a place that we show in a short sleeve.
Yeah. Uniform. All of the different branches of the armed services actually just changed their rules. Any tattoo that was done before the rule change is allowed, but anything you can't get anything that's visible now. So anything that would show on like your dress shorts or the short sleeve shirt cannot be gotten, which actually my friend's kind of complaining about because he just joined the Marines and he was all excited about getting his Marine tattoo, but he can't now.
I think
there was an article I read, and it was talking about the armed forces, but they were also talking about certain local, like, police departments mm-hmm. that were implementing tattoo policies and stuff like that, same for sleeves and forearm tattoos and yeah. stuff of that nature.
Yeah.
And I think also, I can't remember, right, some of the special forces, not just restricted to, just not only sleeves, but yeah, any tattoo.
You
whatsoever.
Can't have an identifying mark if you want to go into the Secret Service or the CIA or the yeah. FBI, so.
When you talk about like this point of action, is there a way to engage some of the concerns that people might have? Like the military might have had that rule. Can you imagine a reason why they might have that rule?
Oh, I definitely can. I'm not saying like the government might not have a legitimate interest in not hiring people with tattoos or not allowing their members to get tattoos. I'm just saying, in the average workplace, instead of you know having somebody view somebody with a piercing or tattoo as know, not upper management material or not somebody to send to talk with the clients or something like that. Try and change the community's view of people with piercings and tattoos to be more positive.
I mean, I guess my question would be that, how do you engage the concerns they would have? Like the military's non-tattoo policy was almost entirely based on they recruit heavily out of underprivileged
yeah.
people, and it's a gang affiliation thing. So their tattoo objection of the military was they want to prevent people from being associated with the gangs they had in civilian life and get them associated with the gang they have in military life. So, I mean, like, how can you engage those concerns about some of the things that tattoos are associated with?
I'm actually amazed the military isn't into tattoo.
They are. They're into you tattooing military stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What they want is they don't want you to think of yourself as a blood. They want
yeah.
you to think of
yeah.
yourself as a Marine.
Yeah.
They want you to swap gangs.
Right.
And so if you're still affiliated with the Crips or the Bloods, that's harmful to their mission, which is to...
Right.
Which is actually, that's the, as a part of the no tattoo policy, they actually implemented a, as part of their health plan that you get for enlisting, tattoo removal. So,
same thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a legitimate concern. Addressing that's kind of hard because that is a legitimate reason to kind of discriminate based on that. Just, you know,
we've got to move on, but I would say in critique that if I would urge you to go in a direction, it's in the direction of the law.
Okay.
And responding to just what Andrew's suggesting, that is, why are these laws there? Why are the constraints there? It's they're fascinating, first of all, just to delineate their existence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of it, and to realize that there is this elaborated sensibility enforced through law about body art is really quite amazing when you think about it.
Yeah. You're preaching to the
actually body. Try and respond, articulate who the people are on the other side, mm-hmm. and what their concern is. That's the empathic part of it, I think.
Okay.
It's a very interesting subject. Thank you very much, Matt. All right, who's up?
Does this need a converter for the Mac?
Oh yeah, you need a dongle. Hmm. You better get a Mac dongle.
I have one at home, but.
What format is your thinking? Like, is it a website or?
It's a website and a Facebook cause, so I could just email you guys the link. Would that work or?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Email it to somebody.
Let's see.
Someone will let you use their laptop for presentation.
Oh yeah, if somebody has a PC.
Use my laptop.
Okay. All right, I just sent it to the list that Andrew sent out earlier, but actually if I had a, can I use somebody's laptop? This was like the very...
Send on the list. Everyone who emailed me to put their names on the list. For those of you who did not email me, you did not get put on the list.
Get the name on the list.
I'm going to mail it out to you.
I thought you were the
Hold on, so if we were already on the list, we'd email you again to stay on the list?
Yes, because they're two different lists.
Not an email, dude, but I have an email.
Well, are you kidding me? People aren't actually getting this stuff. All I can do is send it out over the resources I have, which is the, anything I've sent out has gone out through the My HLS communication.
One resource you have is that all the people are right here, right now.
And when I said, email me to get put on the list, I got three emails.
Because I was already on the list.
Okay. Because no one listens to me when I talk. It's like I'm talking to an empty room. I said, please email me. Make
now
me
you know how it feels to be a law professor.
That's it. I hate myself. I quit.
You don't quit, you're fired.
You can't fire me. I quit.
Should we email you now?
There's also something weird about
it.
Okay.
Have you guys been getting the emails, the few emails I've sent out that come from the Cyber One list? It's like it says Cyber One in brackets. That is what
I did before. I don't know. When was the last time you sent one?
Yeah. I don't know, 3 weeks ago?
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. A month ago? I mean, that's the list that I've been using.
I think I've gotten one email from this class ever.
No, you should guess.
Yes.
If you're wrong, you fail. There's 10 people on the list that Kathy,
yeah.
11 that Kathy didn't send out to.
Well, that was the one you sent out to before, when you sent the link to the Berkman Shield. See. I mean, I guess I can just start since I know we're kind of pressed for time. Did most of you get the link? 11 of you get the link?
We didn't get the link.
I got it.
Yeah. All right, well.
If you didn't get the link, then just send an email really quickly to AM Woods and I'll add you.
That's weird.
AM Woods at law.
Okay, it's not working. Okay. What did we learn? Technology is out to fuck you?
Do you want to use this one or do you want to just do it?
I mean, if everybody has a link, I can just do it off.
No, no, so it's a good one.
Okay, yeah, this is probably easier though.
Can you email it to me in that session? I didn't get that.
A Solomon that one. Actually, I'm on Solomon at Gmail.
Any periods or anything? No.
Nope. AMANSOLOMON.
So I just sent you one from like recent.
Okay. Messing and Dave Levine are both already
on here. I'm not commenting
yet.
I don't know. The only I got Xander. I think yours bounced on me.
Oh, lovely.
Are you A.M. Lee at FAS?
A.M. Lee at FAS.
Yeah, I don't know why it's bouncing things randomly. Oh, wonderful.
Nice.
Oh, I think I got marked as spam.
Okay, I forwarded out Kathleen's email, which, never mind.
Did you send it to her?
Yes. Oh, gosh.
Forward.
Yeah.
I'll type it in there.
Yeah. Oh, I put the period in, that's why. So somebody else just got your...
Hopefully there's none in.
Okay, I'm sending out what should be a complaint email that's not something added to it. So
okay, do you want me to resend?
I just sent it. I just replied
to
all of it.
Okay.
Twice. So
great.
You should have two copies. The most recent one should be a complete list of the class. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay, so my topic is about something I think everybody's passionate about in one way or another, which is food. And I guess just starting to come up with the topic and the arguments, the problems that I had were actually that there seemed to be so many different people arguing for different things, and people that I found myself even aligned with that were arguing for different things. And I wanted to create a space where there was something to focus on, and somewhere that made an argument that was appealing to me, in the sense that sometimes I felt, even just reading through web pages and reading through documentations, that people were just kind of throwing it over the top, and in a way that kind of turned me off. And I know it was argumentation that I could accept, but that a lot of my friends would sort of glaze over and dismiss as sort of granola, hippie, Californian. So I guess the part of my argument is basically that the American food and farming system is broken. But to begin to address how to fix that, how to improve our nutrition, I'm advocating that we think small and start small with small farmers who are a necessary part of the diversity of the agricultural system. I know there's been a lot of debate recently about the Farm Bill and about, you know, whether we should have local foods and local sources. So I guess the way to break down the argument is there's sort of three arguments or three sort of strains of argument that I was finding. There's the very personal local, I want local food, I want, you know, to buy from my farmer's market, I want to support local farmers, this is fresh, this is seasonal, this is healthy, that I think appeals to certain people, but doesn't appeal to everybody. So I wanted to kind of capture pieces of it and also try my hand at a Facebook cause, which I haven't actually used yet. And I like the idea that the Facebook cause could go to support, directly support an organization. And just because this is such a large and multifaceted issue, I wanted to, my concept was to have, not sort of an issue of the week, but sort of a featured cause that people who are concerned about industrialized agriculture or increasingly industrialized agriculture could rally around, get educated about, you know, write letters if that's what it takes, or donate, and do something appropriate. And I guess my argument that I found most persuasive was the argument about food supply based on the spinach contaminants of 2006, which I think really, really highlighted the necessity of having some disaggregation and some diversity in the food supply. Just because in that case, you have industrial agriculture, common washing facilities, common processing facilities, in a way that takes what might be small outbreaks and making them larger outbreaks, national outbreaks. And I mean, obviously, there is something to be said for being able to ship fresh produce cross-country. But the problem is that in response to these outbreaks, the government is sort of implementing reactionary regulation that doesn't necessarily
solve the problem or promote best practices. And in a lot of cases, there's a regulation that makes sense if you are processing 400 head of cattle. But if you're a smaller processor, it doesn't make sense to have to be required to, say, have a bathroom and a shower for your inspectors. And there's things like that, that there's a lot of scale neutrality in the agricultural regulations that just doesn't make sense. And in some cases, and in the case of, actually, this is my featured in the case of, I guess, the featured cause, which is the California leafy greens, a lot of the causes, or a lot of the regulations that they're proposing are hostile to small farms, they're hostile to biological practices, and they're hostile sort of needlessly. They haven't been tested by agricultural scientists. And so this is kind of a way, I guess, to raise awareness about it in a concrete way that people can, who support small farms or support the idea of a more diversified food supply, can come, find information, get links, and, you know, hopefully share something about the cause. And
all right, open for comment.
All right. Dan or Rochelle, I don't know.
Okay, I was just gonna say, isn't a big part of this the fact that consumers tend to treat food as a commodity? And that, with the exception of maybe like organic food these days, like I don't really care where my beets come from or my cabbage comes from. I guess my question is, how are you going to create the market for smaller scale farms, which is rapidly disappearing?
Right. Yeah, I think even with organic, that was another part of it, was that organic's becoming increasingly agricultural, and a lot of people will, you know, sort of accept organic as the stamp. I mean, I kind of call it, I think the term is greenwashing, but it's sort of an armchair environmentalism, like, oh, it's organic, it's great. You know, it's still coming from across the country. And I guess that was something I considered and something that I do care about as well. But I just felt like, I guess having a place, I felt like there was also a lot out there on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this, especially through my Facebook cause, it was kind of getting people to think about food supply. Because I think people caring about local foods and local farms, I think that's what I found when trying to talk to people who don't support that at all, is they sort of turn off as, oh, you know, that's granola California stuff. I don't care about, you know, where my food comes from. And so that's why I was kind of focusing more on, like, you know, yes, there's that reason. And yes, it's, you know, it's good for our environment, it's good for our nutrition, but, you know, it's got a really practical reason that we're protecting our food supply. And so, I mean, that's just trying to, I guess, get people engaged who might not be otherwise engaged. But yeah, I mean, that's a valid point, something I'm concerned about as well.
Okay.
Rochelle, did you?
Oh, I was just saying, are you trying to get people to buy, like, locally, like, from farmers markets? Are you trying to get, like, places like Whole Foods, which currently buy from, like, you know, large-scale organic farms, to buy from smaller, I mean, what?
I mean, I guess part of it is, I mean, things like the leafy greens make it more difficult, the California leafy greens, because supermarkets are signing on. Right now it's voluntary in California, but all supermarkets have to get from suppliers who are certified that, you know, all of their suppliers, all of their farmers have followed the best practices, which aren't necessarily best practices and are overbroad. They apply to fresh cut greens, which have never been implicated. They apply to other greens. But I mean, that's also part of it. The thing about this was, it's such a big issue, and I wanted to kind of, I guess, start small. But yeah, I mean, that's another thing as well. Yeah.
Did you consider adding anything about farm labor that's used in industrialized farming versus farm labor that's used in small farms?
I definitely did. I mean, the basis for this was, it actually started, the best summary I've seen of the position is a website called The Ethicurian, and their emphasis is soul food, which is sustainable, organic, local, and ethical. And they've done actually a lot of work with also thinking about farm worker rights, which a lot of, obviously, the industrial farms, I know there was a big controversy over giving migrant workers a 1 cent raise with tomatoes for Burger King. So I mean, there are a lot of sites out there that do that as well. And then, I mean, if this continues, I'd like to start kind of adding into that. But for now, I kind of wanted to keep it straight to the point.
Who do you see yourself speaking to in this? Who's your audience?
I guess I sort of made my audience in my head kind of two ends of a spectrum. I have a lot of friends from college who are very conservative and want nothing to do with any of this global warming crap or, you know, all your environmental California causes. And I saw the part of this appealing to them as, you know, this is the government over-regulating, which I think a lot of them, that might speak to them a little bit more. And then also sort of the national security issue on that. And then from the other end of the spectrum, I have some friends on, I would call it the more liberal end of the spectrum, who hate the, I think, actually said hate the implied hierarchy of local foods that, you know, basically it's luxury, it's wealth, you can afford better food, you can have better nutrition, so, you know, forget all you poor people. And this is just trying to make the argument, yes, that's part of it. We like, you know, better nutrition, we like better food, but there's something larger here and there's something more important here. And obviously it's not something that's gonna be solved right away. So I guess in crafting this, I made it personal and tried to think of these two groups of people who really get turned off by talking about, you know, sustainable agriculture, local foods, everything like that.
All right, thank you very much, Ken.
All right. Thanks for being here. Sorry, I didn't mean it very much.
All right, who's up?
Go for it.
All right, unfortunately, I don't have anything to show just yet. My idea is to make a flash game that the user plays as the RIAA, and their goal is to keep themselves in business. Basically, it's a whack-a-mole kind of game, or a defense game, which is this whole genre of flash games. It's very popular. And so basically, the way it works is somehow the user is presented with a university or a household or some kind of entity. They have to try to get the information out of it. They'll have certain weapons at their disposal, like subpoenas. Now, some as the enemies progress, some may have defenses against some of these things, like motions to quash, etc. In between rounds, the user can purchase upgrades, which will be called lobbying, which gives them access to more and better weapons, makes those weapons cheaper. And basically, the goal of the game is to put the user in the shoes of the RIAA and make them feel really dirty about what they're doing. And then also because it is a survival game, meaning you can't beat it, you just survive for as long as you can. The idea with that is to impress upon the user that the suing of individuals for copyright infringement will not be a long-term sustainable strategy. also try to get some education in there, have the correct dollar figures for lawsuits, maybe some kind of approximation of the correct civil procedure. Obviously, making it fun will involve a lot of evisceration of the civil procedure. But that's the basic idea.
Did anybody have any comment?
I guess how do you propose to market it or just get it out there so people play it?
Well, there are some established channels for distributing Flash games. They're very large established sites. They do have a problem, though, which is that they may tend to have a demographic that is already somewhat anti-RIAA. And obviously, the goal of a game like this would be to get the people who are not completely zealots yet and turn them into zealots to some degree. There's also just, you know, post it on the website somewhere and try to get bloggers to link to it, try to increase your page rank over time by getting links. All right.
Who's up next?
Okay, I guess.
Anybody give it a hand?
Is it plugged into the back?
It's plugged in.
Is the screen on? On the thing over there?
Yeah, the screen's on.
Push the laptop button.
I don't know why I'm giving advice on it. There's no reason. Button.
Yeah. Oh, do I have to like push the thing here? No, but how do I get my site up?
Oh, to go back?
Yeah.
You hit function in this. But you, I mean, you can do everything, you just do it up under.
Wait, but how do I? Oh, okay.
Which is a Facebook?
Yeah, it's a Facebook. So, oh, I can just scroll down. Wait, I can't scroll down. Okay. So I made a Facebook group, and it's geared towards people with learning disabilities in higher education, and I guess less so geared towards people in secondary school, and people who are their allies. And even though I didn't want to do anything serious, I decided that I would do this because I have a lot of experiences of, I'm very open telling people that I have dyslexia and I don't really care who knows, and I'm just kind of like, you know, if you don't like that about me, then screw you. But I've noticed that a lot of people are really, really surprised when I tell them that, because it's supposed to be this big hush-hush secretive thing that you're ashamed of. And I've encountered a lot of friends that I know that have learning disabilities who will not tell anyone, who I've known for multiple years and who've known that I have dyslexia, who won't tell me that they have this. So the first part of my project was kind of to encourage people who have learning disabilities to talk about it to their friends and to their teachers, because I feel like it's good to let people know that, oh, hey, I know this person who has a learning disability, and she's smart, and she can succeed, and, you know, it doesn't have to be this horrible thing that you have to be ashamed of.
Why? Explain that a little bit to me. What is the shame?
Well, I think a lot of that comes from mainstreaming in schools, of kind of a lot of times kids with learning disabilities are taken out of their classrooms and kind of put into resource rooms, or they're given accommodations that other students think are unfair, so they pick on them. So it's really interesting, because I think it's kind of cool, actually, because, you know, my brain can do really neat things that other people's brains can't do. And so I think that's really cool, but a lot of people are like very ashamed, and there's this sense of, I can't tell anyone because they will judge me and they will think that I'm stupid. And
what can you do that I can't do?
Well, I don't really know that much about your brain, so that's hard to say.
But what is it that you think of as the thing that, what is dyslexia?
I have dyslexia too, so like some of the things I can do, the word scrambles I can do really quickly.
Say it again?
Word scrambles.
Yeah.
I can do them like, I look at it and I can just read it. Uh-huh. Makes sense to me. Speed reading, if you've ever taken a speed reading course, people with dyslexia tend to pick up that a lot faster than people without dyslexia. Huh.
They're great at doing, what is that thing, short script?
Yeah.
They're really good at that too. There's like a host of things that people with certain disabilities will be able to do much better than people without disabilities. So it ends up being an advantage.
Have you ever gotten the, you know the thing where the first and the last letter are the same?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I can read that faster than I can, the thing, it's like an email with a study where if they scramble all the letters but leave the first and last letter the same, you can still kind of read it. You've never seen this?
No, I've never seen
it. Yeah. It's something about how most people, when they read, don't read the interior of the letter, they only read the first
letter. Oh, yeah. I have done that.
I can read that like 10 times faster than I can read more.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really cool things that, you know, people with disabilities can do that other people can't. But people don't like to talk about it because it makes them feel icky inside. And there are people who are openly very, very hostile to people with learning disabilities and dyslexia, who will like outwardly say, oh, I don't believe in learning disabilities, those people are just stupid. And who will truly, truly try and like argue with me and tell me that. And I always win that argument. So I have a second part of my argument that's kind of more geared towards everyone, the community at large. And it's kind of an idea advocating for universal access and universal accommodations. I found that a lot of people have real issues with students with disabilities getting accommodated in the classroom environment. And I think this especially comes up if the school is anything competitive. It becomes this whole thing of, you know, I have these issues in my life. I have kids, so why should this person be able to have an extra 2 days to complete the writing assignment when, you know, I have issues in my life? And so my solution to that is to kind of advocate and create for a system of universal accommodations, which is kind of the idea of, instead of using accommodations to level an unlevel playing field, to create a level playing field in and of itself. So instead of having one evaluation, kind of one form of an evaluation, say, the teacher would just say, okay, we're gonna have this timed exam. And so the people who had the disabilities would get extended time, or they would be able to use this and that that the other students wouldn't be able to do. So instead of having that, having a system where there's multiple ways of evaluating people. So you could choose, if you wanted to do an oral presentation, or if you wanted to do a timed exam, or if you wanted to write a paper, if you wanted to sing a song, you know, so there's different means of evaluating and showing people that suits their best way of being evaluated, so that everyone is able to be evaluated according to the way that they can represent their intelligence the best. And I think that this is, I think that this would be really good for society as a whole, because it would kind of open society up to the idea that there are multiple ways of learning and that everyone benefits when we open ourselves up to multiple ways of learning and evaluating. I think you would have to have some sort of like common ground rules in terms of like, you know, everyone should have to like be able to write a paper, you know, because that's kind of something that, you know, if you're graduating from college, everyone should know, regardless of ability or disability. But I think beyond that, kind of opening it up to a system where everyone gets accommodated would be really nice.
All right, thank you very much. How about comments?
Oh, it's called Openly Learning Disabled.
And for some reason, if you search for openly learning disabled, it doesn't come up. But if you just search for learning disabled, it's like the sixth person, like the sixth group or something. I don't know why the search doesn't work, but.
Yes, question?
In terms of like the pragmatic criticisms of things like this, does it always come down to like money and time? Like in terms of accommodating disabilities and like whether like various disabilities are accommodated versus others, and some of like the drawbacks you saw that people criticize disabilities for is that, you know, if we could all accommodate everyone's disabilities, it would be better. But like some of the pragmatic concerns might be like we don't have the time or the teachers or the money or whatever to deal with pragmatic disabilities. How would you engage those concerns?
I mean, I think that I don't think that it would cost that much money and it would be that much time if you did it correctly. If you did it just in terms of evaluating people in a classroom, I mean, is it going to really take that much time to have half the class be doing a timed evaluation and half the class be doing a take home? Is that really going to take that much more time of the professor?
I guess it would depend on what level you were implementing it, right?
I guess.
I mean, in terms of like if you were implementing a testing system at like the elementary school level or the junior high school level, depending on the testing facilities, the methodology in which, I mean, I would think it would be fairly difficult to design a curriculum that would prepare students for that, or like to design a curriculum that would allow for that evaluative process.
I don't think it would be that difficult. I went to a college that had a lot of universal access policies, and it really wasn't that, it wasn't that difficult. You just, you know, got to elect what you wanted to be evaluated on, what you wanted to do, and then it was evaluated on. And I mean, everyone's engaging with the same material. Everyone's reading the same books and participating in class the same amount. But when it comes to evaluation, that's usually when it would kick in.
I think the idea is great. I'm just imagining what the concerns would be. The second concern I would have would be that, I mean, life's not particularly fair in terms of the evaluative system and like the ways that life evaluates you oftentimes, like in your job or something, you may not have the opportunity to elect the ways in which your performance is evaluated. So to some extent, is there some value in forcing kids to be evaluated in a situation that isn't particularly advantageous to them given their disability?
I mean, I think there is a benefit in the fact that it makes people resilient, but I think that, I mean, learning disabled students drop out from high school at a rate of 30%, and the general population is 11%. So I feel like a lot of times students, not just students who are disabled, students who don't get things, students who have hard economic things, you know, or they, you know, I just don't simply like doing oral presentations. You know, that's going to dissuade them from being in education. And I feel like if it's the choice between kind of making sure that everyone can go through the same evaluative process or opening the doors to education, I choose opening the doors to education.
I really like the idea, actually. And, but one of the things that is challenging, it seems like, is transitioning from different levels of school to other levels of school. Like from high school to college, you have like the SATs, and from college to law school, you've got these like standardized like ways of sorting people out. How do you deal with that, like standardized testing or kind of filtering through like different kind of creative intelligences that are different?
I mean, I think there's always going to be a need for standardized testing on some sort of level. And so you just you accommodate the people in standardized testing that have learning disabilities. That's basically the only way you can do it, because there are going to be certain things that everyone has to go through in the same evaluative process, whether I like it or not. I mean, if, I don't know, you're learning how to be a heart surgeon, you have to do heart surgery. That's you know, pretty cut and dry. But in terms of, so, but in terms of transition, I mean, I think that there would need to be less emphasis on standardized testing. I frankly don't think that standardized testing reveals that much, personally. But I do bad on standardized tests, so that might have something to do with my opinion.
Well, it seems like there's a, in some sense, a tension between accommodation and standardization. Evaluating everybody in the same way is, in some ways, against accommodating certain types of needs. And I think both of those go to some kind of fairness. Do you think that would be a useful nexus to, or a useful issue to look at on your, in your group, in your study, sort of the idea of fairness, which I think kind of gets to concerns on both sides of the discussion?
Yeah, I mean, it does get to concerns on both sides, because you frequently hear, oh, it's not fair for that person to get accommodated, or this testing environment, that's not fair. It's not fair that, you know, when I take a racehorse exam, I don't think as fast as someone else, or they're a faster typer, so they get a better grade. That's not fair. So it is useful to talk about that.
Do you think there's a way of resolving it, or is it just...
I think that you can create a system that is going to be universally fair to everyone, but I think within that system, you have to have multiple options, and you have to have choices and, you know, flexibility within it. But I do feel that the cream always rises to the top. I think that probably one of the concerns that people would have about creating a system like this is, well, if everyone, you know, gets to be accommodated, then everyone's going to do well, and there's going to be no way of really discerning who's smart and who's not. And but I really do believe that people who are smart are going to perform well on either any of their, you know, evaluative methods or in one particular evaluative method.
It does seem, though, that to some extent, part of this comes down to what you think the overall mission of education is, if it's in terms to prepare you, like, for a specific career, for life, or, like, to prepare, or if it's to further the development of students' intellectual capability and encourage them to, you know.
Yeah, and in terms of practical education, in terms of, like, job training, this kind of model would be less effective.
It's like, is this model effective in law school or not? Well, it depends
on the point of law
which
school.
Schools you consider, or what type of skills you consider law school designed to develop.
Yeah.
Who do you consider yourself to be arguing against?
Probably the status quo of education, that there's one way of evaluating people.
No specific set of people? Can't imagine yourself talking to someone here.
I mean,
to whom are you speaking?
I guess to everyone. To everyone who thinks that, like, you know, I would like extra time on this, or, you know, has a life that interferes with their education at times. And to people who are very connected towards having one means of evaluating people. No more standardized tests.
All right, thank you very much. Who's left?
I guess I'll go.
Guys, in terms of the evaluations, I have to run at like 6 because I've got to be someplace very quickly. So I can't stay around for now. I can't stay around very long because I don't want Professor Nesson to pressure you. Or alternatively, somebody else has to pick these up. Will somebody else pick these up? Great, guys. Not all at once.
All right, so this might seem a little frivolous after some of the projects that have gone on today, but I want to talk to you about sneezing. I assume everybody here sneezes, right? Is there anybody here that doesn't sneeze? Can you raise your hand?
I double sneeze.
Double sneeze, that's even better.
Always twice.
All right. So everybody here sneezes, and I imagine everybody here probably responds to sneezes also. That's generally like what happens in our culture. People say, God bless you. People say, Gesundheit, or any other numerous of variations of a response to sneezing. And my question is why? Why are we responding to sneezing at all? And I think historically it's kind of unclear why we respond to sneezes. there are some stories about people used to think that your soul could come out of your body when you sneeze, so it was sort of a blessing to try to keep your soul inside. And people thought that like sneezing was a precursor to the plague back in the days, and they would say God bless you to try to keep the plague away from you, and that didn't turn out too well, I guess. But it seems like in this day and age, people don't really believe those things. Is there anybody here that believes that sneezing lets your soul out of your body? All right, great. So the question is, why do we say God bless you today? It just seems to me to be sort of a distraction. I mean, you're in a meeting, somebody sneezes, or jihad even double sneezes, people are saying God bless you all over the place, and then you have to say thank you, and then it takes time, and it just disrupts the entire flow sometimes of what's going on. So, I mean, and it's an interesting like topic for me, because everybody sneezes and everybody is on the other side also. So you kind of have a perspective of both sides. But I think when you're saying God bless you, you don't really think of what's going on with the person who's hearing God bless you. I mean, does anybody hear when they sneeze and somebody says God bless you or something? Like, how do you feel? Are you like happy that they say God bless you? Does it really make you feel a lot better?
I know some people are actually quite pissed off if you don't say it.
I know, I found that too. In fact, I was talking to my wife about this recently, and she kind of agreed with me, and she went to work, and she told the people, her work associates, like, you know what, it's kind of wasteful, like, if somebody sees this, let's just forget about it. And people were actually very offended by this idea. But they couldn't really, like, say why they're offended. It's just sort of a manners thing, you know? Everybody says it. I mean, if you don't say it, you're not a nice person for some reason. And I don't know. I can't really think of a good reason why to continue this. I mean, maybe some people think that sneezing it shows that somebody's unhealthy, so they want to like show their support in some way. But like people don't really respond to something like coughing in any way. Like people cough and it just goes on. If somebody's coughing really badly, maybe you say, are you all right? And you help them out, but like a stray cough here and there doesn't garner any response. And in fact, coughing is a lot more dangerous to your health than sneezing. I looked up on WebMD the common conditions that are associated with sneezing, and what comes up are things like a common cold, hay fever, dust exposure, indoor allergens. I mean, none of these things seem particularly threatening to me. And conditions associated with coughing are like bronchitis, emphysema, viral pharyngitis, goiter. And like, those things seem pretty, like a lot worse than those conditions associated with sneezing. So if anything, people should be like blessing people who are coughing and not those people who are sneezing, because sneezing is not really that big a deal. And so I guess my argument is, it's just stop saying God bless you to people who sneeze. It's ridiculous. And like, it's hard to really get this out there, because everybody says God bless you. So if you don't say God bless you to somebody, you're kind of seen as in a negative light. Like people are offended that you don't say God bless you. So it seems like the best way to go about this is not to just stop saying God bless you to everybody, because you don't want to seem like a jerk, especially if it's in like a work situation and you're like with a partner and he sneezes and you just like kind of sit there quietly, he might be expecting you to say God bless you, and then you look like a jerk. So maybe it would be good just to start with your friends or something, even talk about it beforehand, and like start a little movement from the ground up. And I was thinking about creating a Facebook group for this very problem, and just sort of working from there. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts or comments or questions. I'd be welcome to hear. Anything? Yeah, right.
Well, regarding the difference between reactions to coughing and sneezing, given that coughing seems to be an indication of something a little more dire to, you know, as a self-interested individual, someone who hears someone else coughing may not be quite so, and, you know, this might operate at a subconscious level, but might not be so willing to say something as charitable as God bless you, when they realize that there's a significantly greater risk of harm to their own person than if it were, say, a sneeze, which I suppose culturally is a lot less threatening than a cough, which I think a lot of people do at some level associate with a lot of those ailments that you listed. So.
Okay, maybe that's true, but then why the response to sneezing?
It'd just be some sort of social lubrication, I suppose, or bonding.
Right, that's what I figure, but then I was asking myself, and I want, if anybody here has a different response, like, really, how do you feel when somebody says God bless you to you? Like, when somebody sneezes, I say God bless you immediately, and I feel like I'm doing something good, but then when somebody says it to me, I really couldn't care less. Like, people say God bless you, all right, thanks. And then, like, I really don't care at the end of the day. It doesn't make me feel really good. Does it make anybody here feel like, yeah, great, these people are really behind me, or like...
Maybe then saying God bless you is for the person who's not sneezing to feel good about themselves.
Right, just to sort of, like...
No, I mean, I think it really is a negative effect, is that if I sneeze in a room, like, if I were to sneeze in this room and no one said God bless you, I'd be like, I never liked that class anywhere, or something like that. Because, I mean, I would feel like no one in here was concerned enough with my health or anything about me that when I sneeze...
Right.
Poor
child.
Maybe it is irrational, but I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you do that's irrational.
Right. Well, I think that part of that is because it's just that sort of expectation that people will say God bless you. So the lack of a God bless you is insulting. But if there wasn't that expectation in the first place, you probably wouldn't care.
So
I mean,
this is a problem of default.
Right. Exactly.
It's like one of Doug's problems. How do you change the default?
Exactly. And I'm not sure exactly how to change it. That's what I was thinking.
Why do you want to change the default?
Because it's just, like, right now, if I'm...
It's a pain in the ass.
It's a pain.
I have some testimony for you.
Yeah.
The default has changed between me and my spouse. We don't bother to say, bless you, when we sneeze. Maybe that's the way to do it, is you start in the home and work.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. Everybody just start with the people around you.
I couldn't disagree more.
There was an episode.
I could not disagree more.
With what?
I think if you're going to make the start, you would start out, and then eventually the people you care about most, you would stop saying at the end. But even then, I don't even like it. I could not disagree more. This entire project, and especially Professor Nixon.
Yeah, go ahead.
There was an episode of Seinfeld about this. Where they tried to replace God bless you with you are so good looking.
Right, right.
would you advocate replacing
No, I wouldn't. Before? I wouldn't really, because I think that the real problem is just the sort of disruptive nature of it. It's just, I mean, do people feel like not good looking when they sneeze? Like, you're so good looking probably doesn't really help them either, and it's just sort of disruptive. Like, I'm talking now, somebody sneezes, and everybody around the class says, oh, you're so good looking, or God bless you, or Gesundheit, or whatever. It would just disrupt the flow of what's going on here. I mean, I guess that's really it. That's the extent of the project. So.
I don't think we say God bless you enough.
All right. Well, thank you.
I sort of changed my project at the last minute, so I don't really have a physical project as of so much right now. After I graduated college, I got into doing sort of endurance races, I guess like marathons and half Ironman. I'm going to try to do an Ironman and stuff like that. And one of the things that is sort of interesting and annoying to me is the entire method by which the whole race registration process, entry process, and these things goes about. It's very sort of easy to find out when exactly registration, stuff like that, opens, but it's very hard to find out exactly when you need to register by. For instance, there's some marathons where you can register up to, including on the day of, whereas there's some, such as the Marine Corps Marathon down in D.C., where if you don't register within the first 2 hours of it opening, you can't get into it. It's impossible to get into. And but it's really hard to find out exactly where these the information about when sort of they close, I guess, is. So unless you go onto message boards and things of that nature. So I guess the first part of my project
and also to find out exactly how exactly they do the registration process. There's all these different ways they do it, some involving qualifying times and things of that nature, and some involve lotteries, and some are just first come, first serve. So I guess the first step, and the lotteries can be altogether confusing. So the first part of my project was I was going to create sort of a series of, like a blog with various parts to it that would allow sort of a clearinghouse sort of, I guess, of information about when exactly, not only when the races are, because there's, and where to find races, because that's pretty much out there anyway, but just sort of exactly what sort of entry system they have and how long you have to enter it. Because the other concern about entries is if you don't get into it, it affects your entire training program. And for instance, for Ironman, I just noticed off the top of my head right now that all the races for 2008 are already filled up and closed, so you can't get into one for two years from now, which most people won't even start thinking about. So the first part would be, as I said, some sort of clearinghouse of information about when exactly they close up and exactly how you have to go about registering for them. And then the second part was going to be a sort of blog sort of trying to advocate changing some of the ways that they change the rules for exactly how they run registration entry, try to broaden the audience and broaden the people who can access it, but still weighing concerns of people who sort of regularly do these things. And so I guess that was sort of the extent of my project.
What are these races trying to get by the way they structure their registrations?
Well, there's two different
highest quality runners, or
well, that's one way to do it. Like Boston, for instance, with the qualifying, they have usually half are you have to qualify with a certain time, and then the other half they let charities run.
But so, you don't have a problem with that. That's not a time.
They do. If like all marathons adopt that, then it would be incredibly hard to have just normal. I mean, part of the fun of it is just having average people, you know, who can, you know, sit there and say, you know, they want to do this.
But like these Ironmen that are all filled up for a year, why are they all filled up?
Well, part of the reason they're all filled up is because, first of all, they, by their very nature, have to be small. They have to be somewhat small just because there's so much logistical issues in terms of coordinating. For instance, in the swim, you have to have people on boats monitoring all the swimmers and setting the waves off and things like that, whereas and the bikes too, there's rules based on the biking where, for instance, if there's no drafting, so you have people going on usually motorcycles or cars monitoring the course. So just in terms of logistics, it's a lot easier to say run that logistically for smaller groups of people. So the part of the problem is that they already have this sort of small sort of group of people who are doing it, but right now sort of triathlon is becoming increasingly more popular. And so you have a huge supply that's sort of this influx of people. And so that it's just, while there's, I guess the market for triathlons, the supply of triathlons is not quite yet caught up to what the supply is. And so the only people who really, by the time someone decides they want to do an Ironman, they're not thinking about, you start training, you know, a year out if you're a regular ed, but by that point you're already placed out of whatever race you want to do. So you have to think 2 years in advance. So sort of the thing is that sort of to advocate sort of maybe, you can't, the problem is also you can't not let people know what they're in it until, you know, the day before, because at that point, you know, you don't want to, you know, let someone do all the training and then, you know, sort of just at the last minute say, sorry, you can't make it in. So what I was thinking is something that's almost sort of a hybrid sort of having a certain number of slots that are qualifying slots, and then also do a certain amount of slots that are lottery slots that are open, just to sort of extend the window beyond, say, a 2-hour period to maybe like a few weeks or something like that, to give a little bit more of a chance for some.